just like I had the story. I think in words and express myself best in writing. Other people might do better talking it out to the wall, a mirror, or a friend. But I do better writing words on a page that I have to read and defend. I'd make the argument against the company in an essay. Then I'd see which argument was stronger. Writing out my inversion would force me to consider every point on my list and make sure I had thought it out fully. It would make the inversion seem more real. I was so resistant to the Whole Foods inversion that I knew I wouldn't quite make myself believe it until I saw the arguments on the page in black and white. Writing it down would force me to take the argument seriously. Later, I sat down and I added to my investing practice folders on my computer. I love folders. In my investing research folder, I made a folder for each company. Inside the Whole Foods folder are company filings, general research, pro opinions, con opinions. Doing the inversion was more painful than I thought. Playing devil's advocate on a company I love was like cross-examining my best friend. It's emotionally terrible, but I also know exactly where to find her weak spots. In the process of working on my fear of buying, I had become emotionally attached to my favorite companies, and that was a sign that the inversion process was vital to protect me from an irrationally exuberant decision. A company that survives an inversion has passed its cross-examination and made it into my buy-it pile. Practice shares. Later that week, I was on the phone with Nuno, and he casually asked if I was going to buy a company soon. He hesitated, yet had some energy in his voice when he asked, while simultaneously staying super laid back about the question, because who cares, man, just do whatever you want, but on the other hand, maybe you should actually do what you've been working on for months. He's breezy. I said, yes. I did not want to say yes. I added, soon. I did not want to buy anything soon. I had promised my dad that I wouldn't. I wasn't sure exactly what scared me about buying shares. It was almost the inverse of the problem with day trading. With this investing practice, buying shares felt like a really big decision that would affect my life for years to come. This wouldn't be an action I took and probably reversed by selling the stock in an hour or a day or a week. This would stick around. Maybe to haunt me. Plus, I didn't know how to use the brokerage platform. Literally didn't know which buttons I should press and when. What if it asks me questions I don't know the answer to? I worried. What if I hit the wrong buttons and lose my entire tranche or somehow buy way more shares than I meant to? Plus, people will ask me which stock I bought. I'm identifying with and representing this company. I don't feel like I can just buy something. Unless I could. What if I practiced by taking a test drive? An emotional test drive. I would pick a company I knew I liked and wanted to own, and I would practice buying a small number of its shares for a very small amount of money, an amount I would not miss. I would not care if it was on sale, not on sale, insanely overpriced, whatever. It didn't matter a bit. It was about the experience, and here's the key, it was not an investment. I would never expect to make a penny on this purchase, and instead would treat it as money that has been paid to buy the educational experience of buying shares, just like a tennis lesson. At the end of it, I would, one, own a company I love, which is always great, two, maybe have lost that money forever, and three, have practiced buying shares with awareness on my emotions, rather than on the numbers. I could keep the shares or sell them the next day. It didn't matter. It was about practicing. Later that month, once I was back home in Boulder, my dad and I had a video call. We did this regularly now. It was much nicer and more comfortable to be able to see each other. Quite a contrast to the stilted phone calls we had when I was a kid. I thought my dad would think my idea for an emotional test drive was interesting. He surely knew by now how I operated and that it would give me some confidence. Instead, when I told him about it, he cocked his head back like I'd punched him in the jaw. You just ignored everything I have taught you. That's not investing. I blinked. I didn't think he'd be insulted. Exactly. It's not investing. It's practice by buying an experience. An experience? What does that mean? The point is to practice how it feels so that when I do it for real, with real money, it's not as scary. I'll have been there before. I can see what emotions I go through so I can manage them when I put a lot of money on it. Well, how much are you going to spend? It needs to be a small amount of money that I don't mind spending on an important experience, and it needs to be large enough that I notice it and have emotions about it. I don't really care about spending $20, but a few hundred is definitely a big deal for me. I have to think about spending a few hundred dollars. And I would spend a few hundred on something important. So, yeah, I think about $250 to $300 will be an amount that I'll feel. He snorted. He didn't get it at all. Okay, what company are you going to buy but not really buy and waste your money on buying at a price that's too high? Whole Foods. He softened a little. Well, at least that's a good one to gamble on. It's not a gamble! That's the whole point! I stuttered. I left it alone after that. No point pushing something he would really not understand. I was going to buy the practice shares anyway. Then it occurred to me that maybe he didn't empathize with my idea because he had never felt nervous about buying a company. I asked him, and he looked at me like I had asked if he had ever gotten nervous about brushing his teeth. No, I've definitely never felt that. And then he got it. I saw the light bulb go on. No, I've never felt that. But you feel nervous about it, huh? Yeah, it's really scary. It's scary enough that I want to practice it. Well, okay, that's definitely different from me. Okay, try the experience thing. As long as you understand what you're doing is not investing and it has nothing to do with what I do. I laughed. Don't worry, I get it. That's exactly the point. It's not investing. It's practice. There are practice shares. He liked that. He still didn't really get it, but he wasn't against it anymore. I'll let you know how it goes. I had not touched my brokerage account in so long that I had to reset my password. I typed in the stock symbol for Whole Foods, WFM. There was a big buy button and a big red sell button right next to it. I carefully avoided touching either one. It was awfully exciting to be on the page and buying real shares, but I did not want to do it wrong. I could imagine myself buying $5,000 of stock I did not want. So my mouse moved very slowly, very deliberately, and I typed in 10 shares. Still, it was fun. I could not imagine myself doing this months earlier. And here I was, freaked out and excited like I was about to step off a bungee jump. A box came up asking what kind of order I wanted. Oh no, I had not expected that. Order? Limit order was the default, so I searched online for limit order, and Investopedia told me it meant the seller would sell it to me at that price or less. I put in a bit more than the current price so that the purchase would be sure to go through. It was 9:07 a.m. in New York, and I knew the New York Stock Exchange opened at 9 a.m., so I was ready. I clicked buy. Holy crap, had I done it right? It's an expensive experience, I consciously reminded myself, not an investment. I'm not investing, I'm experiencing. It's a test drive. Breathe. A screen came up that said order status, and beneath that it said open. Okay, that sounded promising. Did I have to refresh the screen? Did the stock price just jump up, making my limit order too low? As with how you're not supposed to refresh the screen after buying a plane ticket until the purchase goes through, I didn't want to press the wrong button and accidentally buy more shares. I breathed and thanked myself. Thank goodness I was practicing this and not dealing with serious money yet. I mean, this counted, but it didn't count much. I was still waiting on the order status screen. It had been one full minute. Nothing had happened. Shouldn't the market move a little faster than that? What the heck? Why wouldn't mine have gone through? Had I done something wrong? The market opened at 9 a.m., right? I searched for NY Stock Exchange trading hours and discovered the market opens at 9:30. 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., sports fans. It was now 9:10 a.m. in New York. That would explain why nothing happened. Okay, breathe again. 20 minutes to wait. Then I started rethinking the whole thing. Should I change my order price? I should change my order price. Maybe I can get it at like 2 cents less, or 5 or 10. Should I cancel the order altogether and start over? I heard my dad's voice in my head. It doesn't matter what minor price variations are happening if you want to own that company. If you know you have a margin of safety and you want to buy it, that's all you need to know. As long as it's on sale, the actual moment-to-moment price doesn't matter. Fine, I thought. My teacher has spoken. I'll let it ride. Plus, I think my limit order will mean that if the price opens at a lower price than my limit order, I'll get the lower price anyway. Another thing to test out. I decided to leave my limit order where it was. 11 more minutes. I would be useful and fold the laundry. I successfully folded laundry for 4 minutes and texted frustrated emojis to my group text with Kamala and our friends for 6 minutes. A good balance. 9:29 a.m. 9:30 a.m. 9:31 a.m. Nothing changed on my order status page, but I saw my account balance was down about $300. Someone took my money. Did they give me Whole Foods ownership in exchange, or am I going to have to sue them for breach of contract? Finally, after frantically searching the page, I spotted a teeny tiny refresh button at the bottom of the screen. Seriously, this nub looked like it was stuck in the corner and forgotten about. I clicked it, and lo and behold, my order said, filled. There was no fanfare, no congratulations message from the online brokerage, no welcome email from Whole Foods thanking me for becoming an owner. No one knocked on my door to deliver champagne. But I owned Whole Foods. I was an owner, a proper owner of the whole company, just like every other value investor. I wiggled with happiness. I was a conscious capitalist, bar none. Let's do this thing. What happens now? The first thing I did was open my stocks app on my iPhone and add WFM to check the price. I typed in WFM to the quote page, and the stock price was 11 cents higher than I paid. My reptilian brain loved this. Sorry, Philtown. I was a fan of stock I own going up. Straight up. I looked away for a few minutes while I closed my brokerage account's website, and then looked at the stock price again. Now it was lower than where I bought it. What the heck? That was not okay. Then it almost immediately ticked back up, and I immediately felt a pang of regret that I didn't make my limit order lower to catch that valley. Shouldn't I have known to wait a little bit until after the market had opened? I downloaded 2 other stock tracking apps so I would have the most complete information, and left the last app open on my phone. I watched it update itself constantly. Crap! This could be addicting. And maddening. It's not an investment, I repeated in my head. It's not an investment, it's not an investment, it's not an investment. This was making me crazy. I got so nervous when the price fell from where I bought, and so happy when it went up 1 entire penny. I have literally thrown away actual pennies in the trash because taking them to a coin machine is too much trouble. What was I doing? I deleted WFM from the stocks app and moved it and the other 2 stock tracking apps to a spot way at the back of my phone where they would rarely be seen. I kept them, just in case I needed them, but I didn't want to need them. I nested them all in a box I titled Torture. No one wants to click on Torture. And I haven't, ever since that day. I came to terms with the realization that I'm not going to catch the very bottom of a stock price, and I'm not going to sell at the very top. In fact, I've decided to assume that, going forward, I expect to leave some imaginary money on the table from poor timing. I'm not smart enough to figure out the perfect times to buy or sell, and I'm definitely not lucky enough to catch them by accident. I can't even choose the best line to stand in. That's okay, as I would tell my startup clients who called me panicking about investors taking some of their ownership in the company they founded with their blood, sweat, and tears. Owning 100% of a company worth $0 means you cash out with $0. While owning 50% of a company worth $50 million means you cash out with $25 million. Which would you rather have? Then I thought about what a value investor would do. Not look at the torture box, that's for sure. In fact, Monish Pabrai has said he will never put in an order to buy or sell stock when the market is open, so that he won't be influenced by the day's price fluctuations. Considering my experience trying to buy my practice shares, I see why that is. It's genius. Still, a value investor would probably keep up on the company to some extent, right? We've got to know what's happening. Wait, it occurred to me all of a sudden. What kind of regular commitment was I getting myself into? I'm not someone who likes checking stock prices. I hate having to be online every day. If I want to go on a device-free holiday for a week, don't I have to be worried about checking the market every day? I called my dad and told him I had pulled the trigger. I had bought practice shares. And now I was practicing owning a company and all the attendant worries. Had I gotten myself into a life of constant vigilance? No, Dad said. It's not like that. I don't even want you to check stock prices every day. It would make you stressed and crazy about the ups and downs. You're looking long-term at these companies. Knowing what's happening every day does you no good. If there's a market meltdown or something, I need to know about it, though, right? Well, I guess if there's a massive crash, you might want to buy some shares in the companies you've been watching for their prices to go down. But you wouldn't sell the companies you own unless the value is going down. You'd buy more shares of them, actually, because you know their value is fine and the price is a bargain. Okay, I can get behind that. It's strange that all of these questions literally just occurred to me for the first time after I bought the shares, I mused. I mean, I did think about it beforehand, and yet as soon as I bought the practice shares, I suddenly thought of all this research I needed to do. Dad laughed. It seems strange, but it happens to me too. Often, I'll buy a small position in a company I'm interested in, because as soon as I own some of it, I start to understand it in a completely different way than when it was just theoretical. All of a sudden, my name is on the line for that company, and it's real. My reaction to owning a few shares lets me know if I want to keep going with buying more of it or if I should stop and wait. I know other value investors who do the same thing. Wait a second. Did he just say he buys small amounts of shares to see how he emotionally handles it? I teased. It's almost as if, hear me out on this, you buy practice shares to see how you feel. I let that sink in, then noted. But wait, that's impossible, because you think buying practice shares is totally stupid. No, he stammered. I wouldn't say they're for practice, exact. No, just shares you buy to test your knowledge and emotions, exactly like I just did. He laughed at himself, knowing he had been caught. Okay, he admitted. It's like practice shares. It's a good idea. There was something truly soul-soaring about making my dad admit that I was right and he was wrong. It felt like vindicating my 8-year-old self, stuck in the car being questioned by Socrates and then coming up with the perfect retort. Then he appropriated my idea. I'm into it, he exclaimed. Practice shares. Cool. I took my win and hung up the phone. I was getting excited to buy for real. I wanted to get so solid on a company that I would, in my dad's words, load up the truck. But I had no idea how much load up the truck meant. September practice. Pick your favorite of the three companies you've been researching and write the full story and inverted story of that company. Be mean in the inverted story. Try to understand why you should not buy this company. What can go wrong? Chapter 10. Compiling an Anti-Fragile Portfolio. October. This month. Building an Anti-Fragile Portfolio. Writing a wish list buying plan. Tranches. Prepare to manage emotions during events. Emotional rule of investing. The price will go down right after you buy it. Dad, I don't want to fantasy trade anymore. I don't want to do practice shares. I want to be a real investor. I'm ready to use serious money. I want to own something forever. What can I buy right now? We were on our investing video call, me in Boulder and Dad in Atlanta. I was on a mission that month. I had my investing office set up around me. I was feeling investy, and I wanted actionable information about when to buy and how much. Dad looked at me hard, and even through the computer I could feel it. Uh-oh, the year is almost up, and you're starting to feel the pressure to do something. Welcome to the world of fund managers and the pressure to invest. That's why they can't beat the market. What do you think makes a great investor? Buying stock because you need to? Or waiting patiently like a hunter until the right company comes along at the right price? I stared at him. You want me to stalk my prey? Exactly. When you buy because you have to, what are the chances you're going to get a bargain on a great company? They're low. Exactly. He glared at me through the screen. I know, but people who know about my investing practice keep asking me what I own, I said. I don't think I would even care on my own, but every time someone asks me about it, it's like a reminder that I'm not a real investor without buying a company. Hey, you own Whole Foods, no? No, remember? I don't count buying the practice shares. I bought an experience, not the shares. Are you worried you're missing out? Well, yes, that too. Actually, that feeling of being left behind is a serious issue for rule number one investors. There's a little voice inside us that starts worrying that we're missing out. It comes from the power of group consciousness. That's what we feel when we go to a sold-out concert or football game. The power of the crowd pulling at us to join in. Just recognize it for what it is and ignore it. He was right, of course. Buying because you feel pressure is not investing. It's what all those typical mutual fund managers are doing in the market every day, speculating on the direction of the crowd in this industry or that stock. They're not investors. You're saying an investor waits? Patience and knowing what you're buying are what separate investors from speculators. The secret to good investing is to wait. Try to remember that you intend investing to be a lifelong practice, and you've sacrificed to make the time and energy to do this practice so you can become great at it and have these investing skills your whole life. You really have sacrificed, honey. You've spent a lot of time and energy and brain power on investing this year that you could have enjoyed spending on something else. That's really amazing. I shrugged. I don't think I had much choice. I had to do something towards financial freedom, or I was going to be buried by my own life. And you have been doing great. It's good to pay attention to that pressure, though. Even the greatest investors can feel that pressure. Julian Robertson was a fund manager who had a 32% compounded return going to his investors for something like 20 years, and he was so much pressured by his investors to invest as the market kept going up and up and up that in 1999, he finally just threw in the towel and closed his fund. And I think Warren Buffett did the same thing in 1969. Buffett doesn't describe his decision this way, but I think he was feeling pressure from his Buffett partnership investors to invest when he wanted to wait. And he told them they could buy Berkshire stock or invest with Bill Ruane at the new Sequoia Fund or just take their money home with them. Like these great investors, you will feel pressure, but you must not bend to it. The market will come your way eventually. Fine, Socrates, I get it. I'll stand down. What you're saying is to slow my roll? I teased him. He chuckled briefly. If you don't have a company that meets our rule number one criteria, then you do not buy. He was steely-eyed serious again. That's the only way to protect yourself from making a wrong decision based on fear or greed. I hear you not to buy right away. What I need to know is how to prepare. When they get to my buy price, how much of each company on my wish list should I buy, and in what order? Dad gave me an approving look. Danielle, this is where the rubber meets the road for investing. Building an anti-fragile portfolio is what rule number one is all about. Anti-fragile portfolio. In his book, Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder, Nassim Nicholas Taleb suggests that great results come from strategies that benefit from chaos to the point that they are anti-fragile, a term coined by Taleb that means something that benefits from and is made stronger by adverse events. Mutual fund and index fund investors own portfolios that are fragile. Their portfolios are badly damaged by black swan events, unexpected events that create chaos and shock the market into a state of fear. Such events can cause a massive drop in the price of all stocks, a disaster from which an ordinary diversified portfolio might not recover for a decade or two. Think 1929, 1941, 1973, 2000, 2008. Even so, the advice I have always heard is to diversify among companies, industries, and even stock markets. Diversify, diversify, diversify. Have your investing money in all sorts of different things. Efficient Market Hypothesis, EMH, investment advisors, whose basic thesis is that you can't beat the market, are all about how to allocate capital. There's nothing else for EMH advisors to do because they believe that the only way to get high returns is to take a lot of risk and get lucky. When I told my financial advisor friend I would hold no more than 10 to 15 companies at any given time, she looked at me like I was dumb as a post and basically said, "Oh, honey." But she didn't know how buying wonderful companies with missions and moats when those businesses go on sale creates an anti-fragile rule number one portfolio in two surprising ways. First, my dad said that companies with a durable moat do not just withstand or barely eke through market chaos. Wonderful companies generally benefit from events. If there is inflation, their moat protects them from competition, and they can raise their prices as their costs of labor and material rise. If there's deflation, their moat keeps customers coming back, and that protects them from having to lower their price. Even better, the companies with the biggest moats have the highest profit margins and can use major downturns to eliminate their weaker competition through mergers, acquisitions, price wars, and other aggressive tactics. Great businesses emerge from recessions and chaos stronger and with more control of their market niche. As owners, we get the benefit of that, as their stock prices will eventually follow the increase in their market share and cash flow. "Let me make sure I understand this," I said. "The companies themselves are anti-fragile, because even though their stock prices might go down with a recession or industry chaos, their moats will ultimately make them more valuable after the chaos is over?" "Exactly, which makes our rule number one portfolios as a whole, by definition, anti-fragile." "But isn't that also what happens with a nicely diversified portfolio full of mutual funds and ETFs?" I wasn't really seeing the difference, and there had better be a difference, or all this work was not going to be worth the trouble, if all I had to do to be anti-fragile was buy the index. Good thought. That brings me to the second reason our portfolios are anti-fragile and index portfolios are not. We wait in cash for events that bring the prices down. They don't. I can buy all the best companies, but if I pay too high a price, as Charlie says, the vicissitudes of life, those ups and downs that we call events, will massively reduce my overall returns. I could get that 7% we talked about back in February in an index diversified portfolio if I have 20 years to recover from a big recession. But if I wanted to get to financial freedom, I needed to keep my buy prices low, wait in cash, and be ready to take action when chaos hits. Buffett describes it by saying we want to be ready to run outside carrying a washtub when it's raining gold. "To be ready with that washtub," my dad went on, "that means you have to make sure to have investing funds available when a recession hits. If you can do that, you'll eventually have a portfolio of wonderful businesses that you bought on sale in times of crisis that you can sell for huge profits when things go back to normal. That's the key to having a portfolio that is anti-fragile." Passive-aggressive strategy. Dad went on, "Because here's what's going to happen in the real world. The market is going to regularly fluctuate, and you're going to watch the prices of companies on your wish list come down. One day, one of your companies will go on sale below your buy price, and you'll want to buy it. But strangely, you will also not want to buy it." "What?" I exclaimed skeptically. Your effort to make a decision, because you are human, will be all wrapped up in emotions. One of the most powerful is fear. We've talked a lot about fear. That's the one that says, don't do it. But there will be another emotion kicking in as you start to understand this strategy. Greed. You're watching this stock go down, right? And it will occur to you that if you wait, and if the price keeps going down, you're going to make a lot more money when it goes back up. Greed starts to kick in, and now you don't want to buy. You want to wait until the price drops even more. You want to buy and you want to wait. It's like you have two devils on your shoulders whispering opposite advice in your ears. Ugh, I already knew he was right. I would totally get greedy and try to time it just right, and at the same time be worried that my original analysis was in error and it wasn't a wonderful company at all. When I bought my practice shares, I got mad at myself when the price went down one penny below where I had bought it. With practice shares! I could only imagine the angst with real money. The emotional rule of investing says that the moment I buy a company, the price will drop. Entirely. Because I just bought it. The price dropped as soon as I bought practice shares, so it had to be true. And that meant I would never time it just right. Dad noted, trust your work. You did the work, so that your emotions don't screw up your decisions. The only real mistake you can make when you have a wonderful business on your wish list and the price is below your buy price is to do nothing. You've got to understand that. We wait and wait and wait and do our homework, but when it's time to buy, we've got to get aggressive. I started laughing. Hurry up and wait. So this is a passive-aggressive investment strategy, right? I asked. Dad smiled. Absolutely. Passive and then suddenly aggressive. Laziness bordering on sloth when it comes to hitting the buy button. And then suddenly, we're the most aggressive investors in the world. Believe me, buying just a little bit of a company is almost a bigger disaster than buying none. You'll really hate yourself later when this company makes you 1,000% return and you didn't put a lot of money into it. It's a human frailty to be totally certain and then fail to act on that certainty. You will probably go through that process anyway, but hey, at least I warned you. Something important clicked for me. I get why you don't get too worked up when the market is moving around. If it moves downward, you know you're going to benefit because you're a buyer. And if it moves upward, you also benefit from the prices of your portfolio going to the moon. Exactly, he said happily. In March 2009, when I told Maria Bartiromo at CNBC that I was getting back into the market, it wasn't because I was trying to call the bottom of the crash. It looked like it was still going down. I started buying in because the best couple companies on my list at that time were priced as if they were cheap private companies instead of public companies. They were on sale big time, but their stock prices were just starting to move up. That's all I needed for justification to buy. If those two stock prices had continued going down, I'd have been happy to wait longer. If, after I bought in, the prices stopped going up and started going down more, I would have been happy too, because now I could buy more, even cheaper. I told her I didn't know if the market was going to go down to a Dow of 2,500, but it didn't matter to me. I was loading up the truck now. It was the same experience from a different angle I had had when I was learning how to price a company. I felt like I was witnessing the market and utterly removed from its emotional ups and downs. I could see the fear and exuberance other people felt and acted on, but I was able to stay removed and calm because I had perspective on what was happening and a plan to benefit from it. That's anti-fragile in action. I wanted to be like Buffett, ready with a washtub when it's raining gold. That would be a lot easier for me to do if I had a very specific plan ready to go, so that as my mind whirled and I freaked out about the market crashing and all the yelling guys on CNBC yelled even more than usual, I could open up my wish list buying plan and follow it. It would be an in-case-of-emergency plan, and I was expecting and kind of looking forward to the emergency. The in-case-of-emergency buying plan. My dad loves to say that I'm supposed to load up the truck. But what did that actually entail? Should I literally buy everything on my list or only certain companies? As a rule, he stated, 10% of your investing portfolio per company. Then he backed off immediately. These are pirate rules, more like guidelines, really. What does that really mean, though? Don't put more than 10% into a company no matter what? If there are less or more than 10 companies I want to buy, how do I choose? He sighed. Here's the answer, and then I'll explain, because it probably won't satisfy you. You should buy what you like the best. The way I think Buffett would recommend is buy your favorite, because he says to load up on what you've really thought about. I laughed. Of course that was the answer. Always windage. But I understood what my dad and Buffett meant. I had spent time researching, choosing, and falling in love with my wish list. I liked all the companies, but of course I had favorites. It's natural. Buffett was saying that if they're all below my buy price, then I get to buy my favorite ones. I thought another judgment call would annoy me, but I actually kind of loved it. Easy peasy. Just buy my favorites. I could do that. If everything goes on sale, it's a great situation to be in. Remember to be thankful for that problem. Massively, hugely, generously thankful. It's a great problem to have. True, 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 I smiled. That's what I have you around for, to remind me to be thankful when that happens, because I'm going to be freaking out. Nope, you're not going to freak. You're going to know exactly what to do. Here's the question I ask myself. If I can only buy one, which one is it going to be? I have to make that choice? It's good discipline to recognize that these businesses are not all equal in all regards. One might be way under its buy price, while the others are only slightly under. One of them might have a mission you desperately want to support. One might be more certain to grow quickly or rebound from that event. One might have management you trust a bit more. Ask yourself, if I can own just one of these, which one is it? Then ask yourself again and again and again until you know your buying order if they're all on sale. I remembered Whole Foods and Costco on my wish list. I'd choose Whole Foods. Why? Well, Whole Foods seems to be much more on sale. It has better owner earnings than Costco, which is why it has a better 10 cap. I also like the values and the CEO more. If these were private companies and I were going to own the whole thing, I'd definitely pick Whole Foods. Great. Here's the point to remember. It jumped out at you that Whole Foods is your favorite, so this is your number one choice. My dad explained that my wish list should have two components to it, names of companies and the price at which you'll buy them. That wish list, not the market overall, was going to tell us when to actually buy. I started to get it. The wish list tells me what to buy, and the buy price tells me when? Exactly. I just buy the first one on the list that goes on sale? Basically, that's it. That's why we don't call it a watch list like the rest of the world. We only put companies on the wish list that we really want to own when the price comes down, and we pull that trigger and buy it. If they all go down together, for example, in a stock market crash, I should buy my favorite company first and then go down my wish list from there. If they don't, for example, if a given company is undergoing an event, then I should buy whichever company goes below my buy price first. That made sense because who knew what would happen with any of the others? Gotta make hay while the sun shines. I made a first draft of my wish list buying plan, which is also laid out on the PDF for your reference. Wish list buying plan. Priority 1. Company. The lemonade stand. Range of prices? 10 cap. $200. 8-year payback time, $247. Sticker, $480. Margin of safety price, $240. My buy price. I'll look seriously at $250 per share and below. Online alert set up for the price? No, I can't buy it online. Priority 2. Company. Whole Foods. Range of prices? 10 cap, $29. 8-year payback time, $13. Sticker price, $39. Margin of safety price, $19. My buy price? I bought practice shares, and now I want to buy more. Online alert set up for the price? Yes. Whole Foods. When I shared the plan with my dad so he could check it over, he noticed. You used to be afraid of buying, and now you can't wait to buy. These twin emotions are dangerous. You've got to be steady when you're irrationally fearful, and steady when you're irrationally excited. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between the right amount of fear, the kind that protects me, and irrational fear. We all have a hard time with that. The greatest secret of phenomenal investing results is this simple axiom that I learned from Davy Crockett on TV when I was about 8 years old. First be sure you're right, then go ahead. I thought Davy and his coonskin cap walked on water. I would sit on the floor in front of that 19-inch black and white TV and think, that's how you behave like a real man. First, you get sure that you're right, then you just go do it. Warren Buffett must have been channeling Davy Crockett because he came up with the inverse. If you are at all unsure of what to do, wait. Do not go ahead. And that's why, to protect your emotions as a new investor, I want you to buy a bit differently than one chunk all at once. I want you to allocate 4 slices of money, or tranches, for each company. Okay, I said slowly. Tranches? Buying in tranches. A tranche is a financial industrial complex term for slice or portion. Because you're buying a company in the middle of an event, right? And we're not geniuses, so we're definitely not going to time things perfectly. We expect the price of a company to go down and to keep going down. If you buy in tranches, you can take advantage of the opportunity to buy stock in wonderful companies at ever cheaper prices. So your tranche system assumes that the price will go down and lets me take advantage of the falling stock price. Exactly. The price going down, Dad noted, creates an opportunity to buy this great business for an even better price. Think about it like this. If I sold you a $100 bill for $50, would you be upset at your purchase if you now can buy another $100 bill for me for $25? And would you be really angry at yourself if I then offered you another $100 for $10? No, I'd be excited to buy the first one, more excited to buy the second one, and absolutely thrilled to buy the third one. Of course! The fact that the third one was a much better price does not take away from the fact that the first one was also a great price. That's the way you must learn to think about all investments. If you're nervous because you don't like the idea of the stock price going down after you bought the company, your intuition might be telling you that you don't understand the business well enough to own it. Pay attention to that voice inside and revisit your story and inversion until you know you know. But if you know why the price is dropping and you're confident in your buy price and you're still nervous, perhaps on some level you still feel that the price has something to do with the value. Just remember, it doesn't. Price is just what you paid. That's all. It has nothing to do with the value. By planning for the price to fall, I felt excited to think of buying instead of feeling unnerved. I imagined a layer cake with 4 layers. The cake is my entire investing budget for a given company. And each layer is a tranche, 25% of what I want to spend on that company. I buy my first tranche of 25%, then wait for the price to go down another 10% or so, and buy my second tranche. After another 10% drop, I buy my third tranche. With the last tranche, I just wait. Let the thing drop as far as it wants to drop. It might go down another 30%. Wait. And when you're pretty sure it's not going down any farther, and it's starting to go back up, by the fourth tranche. That's so much more work, I complained. What happened to the nice, easy, buy your favorite? If I want $10,000 of that company, why not just buy $10,000 of that company and call it good? You can, Dad said, but obviously you'll miss out on the lower and lower prices. This is a strategy to help you control your emotions, but if you don't like it, that's okay. You don't have to get it just right. If the price starts to go up, I decided, I'd buy my full allocation and be done with it. I did not want to have to follow the price of my companies too closely or open the torture box of apps on my phone. If the stock price popped up too high over my buy price, then I wouldn't chase it. It might come back down to where I could buy it, or it might not. No point in stressing about it. You don't have to get the tranches perfectly right, Dad reiterated. Just be sure you load up all four tranches while the price is still around your buy price. I can see the value of tranching as a psychological comfort. I can tell myself all day that the price should go down after I buy it, but I know from my practice shares that when that happens, it hurts. If one of the companies on your wish list goes on sale and you don't have capital to invest, it does hurt. In one sense, it totally sucks. But rationally, it is a great benefit if the price drops if we do have additional capital to allocate to this investment, because we can buy more at an even better price. So yes, this system of tranches is set up to help us handle the emotions of investing and to take advantage of not having perfect timing. Anything else to help with that? I asked. Another thing I do to keep my emotions steady in times when the market is rocketing around and I'm being left behind is to keep my eye on two important pieces of information about what the overall market is doing, the Shiller PE and the Buffett indicator. Oh, yes, we talked about them months ago. Right, check those. They'll give you good perspective on the market overall. I actually even do one more thing. So automatically, I usually forget about it. It's inconsequential financially, but it helps me. Great, I love details. When the stock price is getting close to my buy price, I buy a small amount to test my resolve. The amount of money is important. It has to be small enough that losing a piece of it isn't a problem, but large enough to make me nervous if I don't really know what I thought I knew. With real skin in the game, my perspective on the company changes. It goes from theoretical to real. Some kind of unconscious mechanism goes to work in my nervous system, and I quickly feel physically and emotionally stressed if I haven't done enough work to have a true sense of certainty. Does that sound a little crazy? He had told me about that already, last month. My practice shares idea must have really triggered him into thinking about how he tiptoes into a stock. I've certainly made mistakes even after I got comfortable with my knowledge of the company. But I do think we know more than we can consciously access. And I know this little trick is used by a number of good rule number one hedge fund managers. What happens is that the stress stops me from loading up the truck until I dig deeply enough into what's going on that I realize that this one is either too hard or a solid yes. There's a huge difference between imagining owning a business and owning it. You might feel that difference in your body. That's so interesting. It's exactly like what I did, I pointed out, by buying my practice shares. Buying a small amount to learn the emotions and find out, now that you have to defend being an owner of that company, if there's anything you've missed. It is similar and similarly useful. Another little trick I pull on myself is to tell someone whose investing judgment I respect that I'm looking at this company. I don't tell them I already own it because they might soft pedal their criticism. Just looking. Then I give them what is essentially a 1-minute story about the company. Why it's interesting. I learned I can't say I like it again because it sets up a change in how this person will respond. Of course, I've already run this idea past friends I do that with, but that was back before the price came down. Now it's almost time to really pull the trigger. And this trick is just a way to nudge the subconscious to trigger any hidden unknowns. I laughed. It was so true. Having to tell someone you respect about being interested in a company had crystallized my own opinion on it pretty quickly. So had telling someone I needed to change my life. After Dad and I ended our long video call, I felt rather introspective. I called Kamala to say hi. Not only had she switched jobs since our rather desperate conversation in January, she had applied for a fellowship to a prestigious writing colony that pays artists and writers to stay at their cabins in the middle of nowhere and do nothing but be creative while they're there. There are so many applicants that the odds of getting in are tiny, but she was accepted. Now she was pondering using that intensive time to launch a freelance writing career. I could not have been prouder of my sweet, badass friend making it happen. I knew Kamala knew that when I was taking action in my investing practice, I thought back to whether I was living up to our January conversation. Neither of us had referenced it, though, until now. Going over the things happening in our lives, she said, "Remember our talk at the beginning of the year?" "Of course I did," I told her. "Well, it's crazy. She laughed a bit incredulously under her breath. But we've both kind of done it. Look at how different things are for both of us since then, and it's not even a whole year yet. It's kind of amazing, I agreed. I laughed too. What else was there to do? I had gone from unconsciously incompetent to, well, I was definitely conscious now, and mentally reviewing my skills to date, I realized I felt pretty competent. I was no longer incompetent and investing on my own? Me? I smiled. We needed to change things, and we did. But I couldn't have predicted it would happen this way if my life had depended on it. No way. That's the power of intention, and the support of a good friend, without having to say a word. October practice. Picking my favorite company puts a smile on my face. Pick your favorite, and write your own wish list buying plan for your anti-fragile portfolio. Then, sit back and take a moment to appreciate that you have a list of companies you have researched on your own and want to buy. How different is that from just a few months ago? Chapter 11. When to sell. November. This month. Calculating reduced basis with dividends and buybacks. Determining when to sell. I was so excited about doing this for real. I made a detailed wish list buying plan spreadsheet and kept it in my investing practice folder. I was no longer afraid. I did not want to wait anymore. I was feeling a kind of Christmas morning desperation to unwrap what's under the tree. I wanted to use what I had learned. I knew patience was the key, but I wanted to get in there and do it now. Buying comes before selling. My dad had said from the beginning that I should not plan to buy anything this entire year, and he hadn't been too happy when I brought it up the previous month. I didn't know if my wanting to buy meant that things had gone better or worse than he expected, but I hadn't gotten this far by ignoring my own instincts. I would wait for the right time and price, obviously, but I definitely wanted to buy. I thought about keeping my decision from my dad, but that went against everything we had built together over the last months. We had become something of a team, he and I. He had invested so much in me, and I certainly wasn't going to leave him out of such a moment. Hopefully I could convince him. I called him up in Atlanta. We would see each other later in the month for Thanksgiving, but I didn't want to wait on this. Dad, I want to buy some shares of Whole Foods for real. It's the right time. I laid my pitch on him. They have a huge brand moat and loyal customers who think in terms of the franchise name. The price is the lowest it has been in over 6 years. I love the company, and I understand its business. The debt is so low it can be paid off with the cash they have on hand. It has great return on invested capital and return on equity for a grocer. And the owner earnings is huge. John Mackey, the CEO, is a genius with amazing integrity and values. The price is just a bit higher than the 10 cap price, but it's such a popular company that the worries about it are already priced in, and I don't think it's going to go much lower than this again. I don't think waiting 2 months will help me any more than right now. I think it's time for me to take a full position. All of it. Now. He thought it over, leaving a long silence on the phone. I let him sit with it, waiting. It was a big decision for him, too. Was I ready? He came back. Yeah, okay. You practiced, and now you're ready. It's time for you to go for it. That was so much easier than I thought. He loved practice shares now, and he agreed that I was ready. I felt like a bird who wanted to fly the nest and had gotten a little nudge to do just that. He trusted me to fly. It wasn't a small thing. As my teacher, on some level, he had his name on the line for my investing choices. Though I would do my own thing, obviously, just as I always had, we were inextricably connected in this endeavor. It felt like a graduation. I was going to own this business for real. I bought Whole Foods at $30.85 per share. And it was a breeze. It was so easy for me that it was almost like a video game. I bought the shares, didn't panic, and ignored the price I bought at. It was so easy that I wondered if I had actually just spent part of my precious investing funds or if I had imagined the whole 5-minute experience. As I logged out of my brokerage account, I wondered if I should do it over again just to make sure it was done. I leaned back in my chair and remembered sitting in that exact spot, quivering while buying my practice shares. I was so happy that I had practiced buying shares. The pendulum of emotions had swung so far the other way, I couldn't quite believe it even as it was happening. And I really did want the price to go down, not up, so I could buy another tranche even cheaper. I was feeling pretty anti-fragile right about then. I guess that's what all my practice was for. For Thanksgiving, my parents, they get along well enough now to have holidays together, my dad's wife, my sister and her husband, my sister-in-law, and I gathered as a family at my sister's house in San Diego. We had a guest there. Nuno flew in from Zurich to meet them. No pressure. They were eager to meet this guy I had been changing my life around for and show him what American Thanksgiving is all about. After all the turkey and mashed potatoes and wine, we scattered around the house, chatting, doing dishes, and watching football. American football. The real football, which the visiting European among us was smart enough to accept without comment. Dad and I collapsed on the side couch in the living room. Something was nagging at me that I needed to ask him. Now that I was a real investor, how would I know when to sell? I couldn't just keep holding companies forever. Sagely, slowly, like a Zen koan tinged with Pinot Noir, my dad replied, "Buffett says the right time to sell a company is never." Never? Had the Thanksgiving turkey's tryptophan gone to his head? I made him an espresso to perk him up, and then kept at it. In real life, though, I clarified. In reality, when do you sell? I'm serious, he insisted. Unless the story of the company changes, you should never sell that company. This is another mistake I've made because compounding depends on holding on for the long haul. I bought a lot of companies in 2009 that I sold in 2015. I should have held on longer because they're still going up. It's all in the attitude. You should have that attitude of never selling when you decide what to buy. A smart investor who buys a wonderful company at a good price should not be thinking about selling that company ever. Doing less actually accomplishes more. I took his point as a metaphorical one. Have the attitude that I'm never going to sell this company, and I'll take buying it a lot more seriously. Just like our motto, thankfulness. Planning to own a company forever would definitely put me in a serious commitment frame of mind. Still, I needed to know how a rule number one investor takes profits in real life, in the real world. I wasn't going to lock up my money forever. Buffett sells companies? Absolutely, Dad agreed. Buffett routinely sells companies. And yet, he says he never wants to sell companies. How do we reconcile that? I stared at him. Exactly my point. The reason is that he only sells when the story changes. Only. Otherwise he'd keep it. Why sell? I stared at him some more. Think about it like this. You're trying to find maybe 20 great companies you can buy on sale in your lifetime. What makes these companies great, by definition, is that they have big moats that protect their profits, low debt, a lot of owner earnings and free cash flow, and they're led by great people with a mission that matches your values. If you owned the whole company, you'd never, ever sell it. Definitely, I agreed. Especially if it had dividends coming off it into my bank account. However, he went on, companies don't last as long as they used to, even wonderful ones. Now, new ideas replace old ideas faster than ever in history. 100 years ago, the average lifespan of a company in the S&P 500 was 67 years. Now, the average lifespan of such a company is 15 years. We investors have to be aware of how the story is changing, most often by the moat being breached by a sea change in the industry, brought on by a major shift in the way people consume. Look at what Amazon is doing to retail stores, or what health consciousness has done to the center aisles of a grocery store, or what the iPhone did to Nokia and BlackBerry. These changes in shopping or culture or technology are a form of creative destruction. I had seen it many times in my startup and venture capital work. A new idea would come along and change the paradigm for